You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 159. It ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much can you take and keep moving forward? That's how winning is done. Rocky Balboa.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T, chart. Well, guys, today on the show, we have writer-director James DeMonaco. And James is best known for being the creator of the extremely popular film series, The Purge. He is also the writer of Jack with Robin Williams and directed by Francis Ford Coppola, The Negotiator with Samuel Jackson and Kevin Spacey, also co-produced and wrote Assault on Precinct 13, and his newest film is called This is the Night, which is an amazing little film that he made that takes place, wait for it, on the day of the opening of Rocky III. The entire movie takes place in one day, and it centers around the opening of Rocky III. And I was just, that alone, that pitch got me interested in seeing this movie, because I obviously love Rocky III, but that someone was insane enough to write a movie about Rocky III being the center of this, like, of all these characters going through their day. And it's Rocky III's opening in Staten Island, what that meant back in the 80s and all that kind of good stuff. But James and I had a fantastic conversation about how he got his start, about what happened with The Purge and how he was able to create that world, his misadventures in Hollyweird and all the journeys he's gone through, and just his writing process, his toughest days on set, and how he overcame them, and so much more. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with James DeMonaco. I'd like to welcome to the show James DeMonaco, man. How you doing, James?
Good, Alex. Thank you for having me, man. Really, man, a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you so much, man. I appreciate that, brother. Thank you for being on the show. I've been a fan of your work for a while, man. And as I dug deeper into your IMDb, I was like, oh, he did what? He did that too? Like, what? So I have tons of questions, and we're definitely going to get to your new film, This is the Night, which I've had the pleasure of watching. And we're going to go deep in the weeds on that one, because it's a fun movie and very specific, as we were talking about off air, which we'll get into. But before we jump in, man, how and why did you want to get into this ridiculous business?
That's the perfect word, ridiculous. I think, and what's weird, my newest movie, I think, explains it the most. I was just a movie addicted kid. I was so moved by films, moved by movies, that I remember seeing, it was something on, you remember, you're a New Yorker, you probably remember this, mm-hmm. although it was probably all over the country, there was something called the 4:30 movie on ABC.
Yeah.
I can tell you're younger than me, but so it might not have been around when you were of age, but it was a 4:30 movie, ABC, right after the soap opera Edge of Night. And they had theme weeks. So you'd have Steve McQueen week, Paul Newman week, Monster week, Dracula week. And I became obsessed, my mom said, at the age of five with this 4:30 movie. And that was my introduction to cinema, just every day. So no matter what I was doing, it was kind of known in the neighborhood. I grew up in, 7 years in Brooklyn and moved to Staten Island. No matter what age, where I was, the neighborhood would hear my mom saying, James, it's 4:25. And everybody knew we were playing wiffle ball, touch football. I was stick ball. I was going in, cut down, guys. I'll see you in an hour and a half, 2 hours when the movie's over. And I went in, and that was kind of my film school. And but it was beyond that, too. My dad, I joke with him. I think he took me to very inappropriate films, not X-rated films. He took me to R-rated films.
Yes, mine too.
At a very young age. Like I saw Apocalypse Now. I think I was seven. I should not have been sitting.
No, man. I think most 20-year-olds, it's a rough ride for 20-year-olds, let alone 7-year-olds. Mine's was Beverly Hills Cop, Flashdance. Okay.
Yeah, you're younger.
I'm a bit younger. Yeah.
So Apocalypse Now when I was seven, but that's the movie I think that's the one that changed everything, in that I remember leaving the theater saying to myself, whatever just happened to me, because it was almost a traumatic experience. Yeah, yeah. I have to be part of whatever just happened on that screen, because I felt like I was watching, and I'll never forget the feeling, I felt like I was watching another human being's dream. And I was blown away by that. I was blown away. I was like, that's the closest I'm ever going to be inside someone else's head, the imagery that I just saw. And I've always felt that I like films that have, not that films that have a dreamlike quality, but I like that I'm inside someone else's head. I want to be there. And the more interesting the person, the more interesting the dream you're showing me. So that was the movie that changed it all. It's like, I got to get inside that. I got to do that.
Yeah. And the thing with Apocalypse Now is a lot of people look at it as a narrative, and it is, it has a narrative, obviously, but it doesn't, it's an experiential film, like 2001, Space Odyssey. Like, you experience that film. It's not as much on a, like, you, like 2001's hard to keep the story. The story is, it's just the experience. You walk out changed, and Apocalypse Now is that as well, let alone for Francis and the whole team that shot that. And by the way, and anybody who's listening, you've got to watch Hearts of Darkness, the documentary about that movie. Ugh.
Best filmmaker. I'm having, it's the best. Documentary about filmmaking ever. I think, right, hands down.
And I mean, he almost killed himself a couple times. Yeah,
Martin Sheen almost died doing storms. His wife, everything, madness. Like, but it captures that insanity, as you know, like the insanity of being on set, the pressure, the money pressure, the creative vision, all that shit we talk. So it's but that movie, that documentary says it all. That captures it all.
So, yeah, absolutely.
I worked with Francis later, which was,
maybe we're going to get into that in a second. Absolutely. Yes. But so you get into, you walk out and that movie, you're like, for me, it was E.T. Like, I saw E.T. and I was just like, I don't know what I just saw, but I want to be a part of it. But then I put it away until I got into the video store in high school. Yeah. And then I was exposed to like hundreds, if not thousands of videos. And it was a whole other world.
Video changed everything. But it's weird you say put it away, dude. I don't want to babble, but
yeah,
that was also something about our youth that's so different than now. I saw Apocalypse Now. It changed my life, but I didn't have access to seeing it again
for
5-7 years, I think, after that, from when video came. So it wasn't even on TV. I don't think Francis allowed it to be on TV. Mm-mm. So it lived in my head in a very specific way without a repeat viewing, that I think it grew. It grew into this mythological beast inside my head. And I think that was wonderful that I got to live with it in a very personal way. Listen, I watch movies over and over again, so I'm kind of I go against what I'm saying there, that I love watching movies over and over again. But there was something about that when we were young that we didn't get to watch it immediately again. We learned to we just had to live with this kind of impression.
Oh, for me, it was Star Wars. Like, I saw Star Wars. The first time I actually saw Star Wars was on TV, on a black and white, this inch TV is the first time I saw Star Wars, which was horrible, but I had already seen Empire Strikes Back. Gotcha. And I'd already seen Return of the Jedi.
Empire first. Wow.
Because I was young. So I didn't get to see it. So I saw Empire in the theater. I saw Return. But Return was the one that really blew my mind, because I was older at that point. And then I saw Star Wars. So Star Wars was this mythical thing that it wasn't around. I couldn't see it. It was insane. So, but it's a weird thing. Even Scorsese and that whole generation talks about, like, having to go to the art house cinema to watch things like a Kurosawa retrospective or a Kubrick retrospective or something like that, that you would get to watch these films again. But then when the video stores came, you get to watch it again and again. Now, literally anything, anytime, as many times as you want to watch.
Dude, any moment. Any moment. Like Ethan Hawke wrote, my buddy Ethan, I made a bunch of movies with him. He wrote to me last night. He goes, you must go see Out of the Blue. You must see it. Like it's a Dennis Hopper film from 1980. And I had never seen it. I heard about it with Linda Manz. But immediately, like I was able to watch Out of the Blue last night. Like I got to it immediately. Like, boom, let me search a couple of things and there's Out of the Blue. Okay. So the access now, though wonderful, also takes away, it makes everything seem somewhat normal. It's almost, it takes away from the event of film.
It's almost disposable. It's almost disposable. Yes. Where exactly. When you went to a theater, it wasn't. Even if you went to the video store,
it wasn't.
It wasn't. But now you have Apocalypse Now next to a $1,000 indie movie.
Dude, exactly.
In the same queue.
Yes.
And then sometimes it kind of like dilutes.
Yeah, it dilutes it.
That magic.
The glut of content takes away from it being so special. And that's what's scary. And that's one of the reasons I made this movie, is to say, wait. There's something about that communal aspect of the theater, the event of it all, driving to the theater, waiting online, makes it all special. We've taken all that away now. All that's gone. You know?
Literally now, because of the pandemic, it's like really gone.
We've accelerated what we were already hearing right before this all happened.
Right.
We were hearing about the death of the cinema, and now I think COVID has accelerated it. I hope that there's a fuse that people want to get out of their houses and it gets reunited.
It will. But I think it's going to be a different than what we remember it. It's definitely never going to be the 80s or the 90s or even the early 2000s.
No.
It's just not. That's what I'm really curious about Avatar. When it finally does come out, is everyone going to go out to see Avatar again? Is it going to do what we all hope it's going to do? Is James going to save us all?
Is he going to save us all? Right, exactly. You look at I was looking at the box office of Titanic recently. Someone brought up to me that it only opened 20 mil.
It did.
Dude, that opened at 20 mil, but it held 20 mil every weekend.
No, it did 20, then it did like 30, then it just like did 30, and then it just kept going up. And then it slowly, and I remember because I tracked it, then it went down because it came out Christmas. Then it like for the few, it went up a little bit, then it like started holding. Then Valentine's Day came up and it jumped to 60, and then it dropped back, and then it just started to drop back down again, slowly like 55, 45. It was just an insanity in 97 money. So
exactly.
I can't imagine
something like that happening again. You know what I mean? That's what's scary. I hope
the last time that happened was Avatar.
Yes.
I mean, even the Avengers, even the Avengers, all their money is up front. But Avatar held and people kept going because it was an experience of going to see it in 3D. Only 3D movie I've ever enjoyed is Avatar.
Same. I'm with you. Same here. I'm not a big fan of it. That was the one I enjoyed. Exactly.
And that's the only time I would watch. Anyway, let's get back on track. Because I know we're going to have, this is going to be a fantastic conversation. We can just keep talking and talking and talking. So you want to get into the business. You start writing scripts, I'm assuming. You start writing a whole bunch of scripts. You write a whole bunch of bad scripts.
Oh, God, bad.
A bunch of bad thing. How do you get your first script sold? And was that first script Jack?
Yes, indeed. It was, so I started writing scripts at 12, very early. Bad.
Nice.
Like you said, it's bad. I always tell people that. Write bad scripts. Start bad.
Get them out.
Get them out of your system. So very bad scripts. Something called Clear Red Slant. You have flying cars. Bad kids in the neighborhood. A lot of bad kids in the neighborhood. Tough guys. All those guys I was scared of. You know, all that kind of thing. Writing about, you know, Staten Island, Brooklyn stuff. And then, so probably literally 20 scripts before anything worthwhile, even to people. I look back at them now. They're almost incomprehensible. But also trying to find scripts to read. Back then, almost impossible, right? Like, Manhattan, though, you could walk the streets. There used to be, I don't know if you remember this, dude. Manhattan, dudes on corners.
By NYU.
Exactly. I found Young Guns at the age of 19. I got Young Guns. Holy shit, Young Guns 2. But it was the first script I saw. I'm like, this is unbelievable. I remember it was John Fusco, great writer.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is just the first screenplay I ever saw written. Other than I had Sid Feld's books. I think I'm saying Sid Feld.
Yeah.
Screenwriting guru. Oh, that really was the way I learned about the structure of screenwriting. But beyond that, there was no internet, no access to really anything. So writing all bad scripts, right? So I go to I don't know anyone who has any connection even to Hollywood or indie film, if that even existed. And I go to NYU. I'm there for grad. I'm there for a little while, not enjoying the experience. I don't want to badmouth it. It wasn't for me. A lot of guys, a lot of people there had a lot of money to make. Everything was about your senior thesis film, building to that. And kids had a lot of money. They were shooting films for $50,000 to $100,000. Maybe with my bartending deli money, I could scrape up $2,000 to shoot a film. And I'm like,
yeah,
you know, they're getting actors to be in their films too, like Danny DeVito, Daryl Hannah were in some short films. And I'm like, this is insane. I'm not going to. So long story short, I was about to quit. I met a guy there who had raised money through his dad. He had no money himself, but his dad had access to some money. And he asked me to write it. He had seen something I did small. It's a man named Gary Nadeau, wonderful filmmaker. And he's like, oh, write my short film. Could you write it? So we wrote it together and we ended up winning what's called the Student Academy Award for the short film that he directed. I wrote, co-wrote and produced. And we got off that William Morris as the agent, as his agent. And we're like, wow, this is a big step. And then I met with him because I had wrote it and I had all those trunk scripts. You know, I had 20 scripts that I had written over the years, but most of them were very dark. And Gary was a more Spielberg like director, Zemeckis, a kind of ET-ish kind of guy. Mm-hmm. And the movie we wrote, the short film, was also in that vein. It was called Red. It had a very contemplative, good feel to it. Long story short, they're like, you need to write something. DeMonico's scripts are too dark for Gary to direct. Write something, a feature that Gary could direct. Maybe we could sell it. Who the hell knows? We end up writing this thing in 17 days based on a crazy idea we had one night drinking tequila at his Manhattan apartment about a kid who ages fast. And we banged out the script for Jack very quickly. And lo and behold, we give it to the agent. They're like, oh, we think there's something here. And they start sending it around. We were flying out simultaneously, to give a crazy story. We were flying out for the Student Academy Awards that Monday. We gave it to them on the Friday. Mm-hmm. So over that weekend, they read it. We're on a plane. We land in L.A. And the ex-head of Hollywood, this is almost fantastical. The head of Hollywood Studios, Ricardo Mestres, he had just left his post. They gave him one of those golden parachute producing deals, is in a limo waiting for us at LAX saying, I want your script. This is out of a movie. I'm not kidding, dude. We're like, what? Who are you? So we on a payphone, we don't have cell phones. We call William Morris. They're like, yeah, there's a bidding war going on and he really wants it. But don't commit. Go have a drink with him and then get the limo to take you to William Morris. Dude, crazy. And I'm a kid. Gary's a kid from Cleveland. I'm from Staten Island. I'm like, this is madness. We're in a limo, a big power player in Hollywood.
Right.
We but Ricardo, he's making secret phone calls during the meeting. We go to William Morris. There's a bidding war on the script and ends up Disney buys it for Ricardo. And thus begins the weirdest journey of my life and inauguration into this business. Jack goes into production. They get rid of Gary because Robin Williams is interested and Robin wanted Francis. And somehow Gary's let go.
Yeah.
Francis, I mean, it's hero. Yeah, we all understood it. Okay. I was baffled that Francis wanted to do it. It was a good feel, yeah. Small movie. So
it's not a Francis. Yeah, it's not a Coppola style film.
Not in any. It was a very sweet. Emotionally, it was kind of like a movie that was around that time called Searching for Bobby Fischer. That was the original.
Oh, so
which good. We loved, Gary and I. And it was in the world. That's what kind of filmmaker Gary was and still is. And then, so Francis is just his, it wasn't his style, to be just blunt. It wasn't in any way, shape, or form. So we were shocked by that. Luckily for me, because Jack did not turn out, I could be very honest about it, did not turn out at all how I wanted. Mm-hmm. The experience was amazing because I did get to live with Francis on his at the winery for over a month.
Oh. Gary,
which was dude, just as a, and I was 24 at the time. I was quite young at this moment. I luckily had taken a couple of those trunk scripts, showed them to William Morris, and they had sold them. So I had a couple in the pipeline, one being ended up being The Negotiator.
Nice.
And I had a couple I sold called, another one called Fire and Rain that almost got made at New Line, another one called Jack of Fools that was at Oliver Stone's company at the time. So I started my more genre stuff that was more me, I should say, whereas I had this weird thing going with Coppola and Gary, my partner, my writing partner at the time, on the Jack script. And then, dude, to be quite honest, it did not end up the way any of us, I think, thought. I hate saying the word misfire, but I think Francis would also call it a misfire. It's a strange movie that didn't coalesce appropriately.
You know what? I mean, I've always been anything Robin Williams does, I'm a fan. You know, and I miss him in a way that it felt like I knew him, but I didn't. But so Jack has a very special place in my heart. And then that it's so odd because it seems like a Robin Williams movie.
Yes,
but it doesn't seem like a Coppola movie.
Exactly, that's the perfect way.
Yeah, and there was a young Jennifer Lopez in it at the time, a very young Jennifer Lopez, I remember.
Yeah, Diane Lane's in it.
Diane,
Yes, Stanley. Bill Cosby's in it.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So let me ask you a question, though, man. Like, Apocalypse Now is the movie that got you going to this. Like, what is it like meeting Francis in the winery? I've been to the winery. I've been to the winery. I haven't met him, but I've been at the winery, which is insane. That winery is it's insanity.
Yeah. Dude, living. So you walk in, we meet Francis. I fly in. He specifically calls me to, and here's the fun part, dude. I'm living at home at the time. I don't have a pot to piss in. I'm living with my parents in Staten Island. I'll never forget this. I'm playing hockey in the street, literally roller hockey with the guys from the neighborhood. My mom yelling out the window, said, Francis is on the phone. He's calling my house.
How old are you? Like, how old are you?
I'm 24.
Oh, Jesus.
Just turned 24. I'm a kid, right? Still playing roller hockey, bartending.
Right.
And Francis Ford Coppola is calling my house. My mom is like shaking. It's Francis. He's talking to me. And he was calling to tell me about some software he wanted to email me. I didn't know what email was. He's like, you got to get email, James, so we could send the script to each other. I didn't know what he was even talking about. I had no email. So it was just wonderful. I still have the message, him saying, hi, Mr. and Mrs. DeMonaco. It's Francis Ford Coppola. I'm looking for your son. We have the message on the tape. My parents saved it.
Oh, my God. Oh, the tape. Of course, because it was a tape.
Yeah, it was a tape machine. So long story short, dude, it was a very strange. So we go to Gary and I go to the winery and I have pictures. I wish I had them. I don't have. I should get. I was going to show you one of me on the Apocalypse Now boat. It's in the middle of the winery in a giant field sitting there. This boat, the boat from Apocalypse Now that Fishburne and Sheen and Bottoms were on, my top five favorite film. And every night, Gary and I would sneak out to the boat. He let us. He didn't care, Francis. And we just hang out on the boat drinking beers and drinking and talking. And Francis would come visit us. And I'm like, this is not really happening.
This is a dream.
Right? It's like, so the experience was lovely. And he's a lovely man. He's a wonderful human being. And unfortunately, I think for all of us, it just didn't come together artistically the way, but I wouldn't trade the experience, I guess. You know, we got ripped apart by critics. I remember Gene Shalit called Gary and I villainous nincompoops when he saw the film, which I'll never forget. That was
my first. So easy to criticize when you're sitting on the sideline.
Yes, exactly.
So easy.
Boy, that's hard. I got to get used to this business now.
Oh yeah, yeah. They don't hold punches. No. But then you're working with Francis. What was the one lesson you took away from Francis? Because I'm assuming he just was spitting out gold left and right as far as just story and structure and things.
Yeah, I think it was about writing. It's it's not so precious, especially if you want to direct. Don't be so precious about it. It's ever changing. And you got to keep changing with it. Be inspired by everyone around you and don't be like, no, I'm beholden to the word. Don't be that director because he thinks directors like that ultimately do fail because they're not open to the artists around them, meaning actors, production, whoever's giving you that nugget that you should then change, or even a studio exec who's good. There are good ones out there. Good. If the notes are good, hear them, absorb them, and don't be just like locked in. He always felt that the people who are too locked in and saying, I don't change a word, really don't get too far. You got to be open to really making it better and better and better. So I always thought it was kind of, because back then I was a pain in the ass 24-year-old. I'm like, no, I wrote it. That's what you say.
And I have to ask you this, man, because I know where I was at 24. How was the ego? How was the ego during that time? Because you're 24, you're from Staten Island, you're flying out, hanging out with Francis Ford Coppola on the Apocalypse Now boat. Like, I gotta imagine that the ego has to be out of control.
Absolutely, dude. And I got reprimanded, dude. No bullshit. I got reprimanded by, I'll never forget this. So we sell the script and, you know, with the talk of the town,
sex
sale, all that bullshit. And we get sent around. They sent a UTA, now I'm with UTA, it was William Morris at the time. Sent us to do meetings, just meet everybody in town.
Water bottle tour.
Exactly. And then right after that, I sold those other two scripts. And I was probably full of beans at the time, thinking I'm hot shit at 24. And the studios, I won't say who, there was a couple of studios who called the agents and said, you know, your boy sits there with his leather jacket on thinking he's top of the world. He's got to be a little more open to what we have to say. And it was a great lesson, though, man. And really, I needed it. I needed a little smackdown. You know, because You know, and then listen, Jack came out. I got a big smackdown. So it was.
I can imagine a 24 year old James with a leather jacket from Staten Island.
Boy, Mean Streets jacket on.
Yeah. You're sitting there going like, "Who these freaking West Coast guys know?"
Exactly.
That's amazing.
You learn. It's a process, and I think I matured very quickly. Though I was, in a way, Jack forced me to say, "Okay." Okay, this is much tougher.
Because you were for a moment, you were at the talk of the town and you were going up and you're like, you couldn't get bigger than working with Francis Ford Coppola and Robin Williams
exactly.
On your first spec script. It's pretty unprecedented. So you're on this, it's unprecedented. And then you're like going up and then, that's the town.
You, exactly.
One moment you're the hot shit and the next, who are you?
Exactly. Who are you? You're the guy who wrote.
Send him to voicemail. Send him to voicemail. So from there, how did you get involved with this assault with Precinct 13, which I love the remake of that? How did you get involved with that?
So I'd written The Negotiator with another buddy, another childhood friend, and then we weren't doing much together. We had done a TV show together, but we were kind of not. It wasn't real partnership. We had just written that together, and then some French guys who I became very close with had loved Negotiator. Negotiator was very beloved in France, which I didn't know. And they had bought the rights to Precinct 13 for a French director named Jean-François Richer, good French director, to remake. And they just had this thing like, oh, the guy from Negotiator should write it. And they called me through a man named Jim Stark, wonderful indie producer, produced some of the early Jarmusch films. Anyway, Jim was in New York and he knew me through a woman. Called me, said, these French guys want to meet you. They flew in. I hung out with them. I'm like, this is the weirdest now connection. And they were from a very renowned kind of what we would call art film company called Why Not Productions.
Okay.
I don't know if you know, they make all the Arnaud de Plessen films, Jacques Audiard films, Rust and Bone to A Prophet. Wonderful films they make over the years. They've won Cannes many times, but they love genre movies. The French love genre movies, which is wonderful. They love crazy, beautiful, dramatic films. They love genre films. They love Carpenter. And they were like, let's do this together. And I said, well, I just want to get the blessing. I'll come up with a take. So I made the cops the bad guys. That was kind of my take on changing it. Like, oh, let's make the cops the bad guys and this, not the gang members. So it's cop on cop. I thought that was kind of subversive. But I wanted to pitch to, I wanted John's blessing. So we met John. We all met John. John loved the take on. He's like, that's cool. And having John's blessing, I said, let me go up now. I'll write it. And we were able to get the financing from Focus, and Jean-François did a pretty good job. And it was a great, that's where I met Ethan. And I also met Sebastian Lemercier, who ended up becoming my producing partner. We started a company together, and he's now produced all the Purge films with Jason Blum. And also my new one, This Is the Night. And my first film, Staten Island, New York.
But you did you write with John on this? Did John work with you? No.
No, just met him that one time, dude. That was it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. How was meeting John, man? That was
he's still the coolest dude. The long hair, you know. I wish I was John Carpenter. So to this day,
when I grow up, I want to be John Carpenter.
John Carpenter. I saw him. Me and my buddy Steve, a local DJ here on Staten Island, bought me tickets to. John does these concerts. I don't know if you know about them.
Yeah.
And we went to the one up on Pier 48 here in New York. John plays all the music from his films, big stage, scenes from the movies, sold out. This many many years, right. 3 years ago. Wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah.
That's pretty
awesome. If you get
to
see that, look for that. John's traveling music tour is great.
So, all right. So you're writing and you're doing really good. You're the Negotiator. You got Jack, you know, you're a working writer at this point, but you want to direct.
Yes.
Yeah. Because everybody wants to direct.
Indeed.
Everybody
wants to do it, right?
as my old joke goes, when I go into an Uber in LA, I go, so how's the script?
Every coffee shop, every gas station attendant in LA. Yeah. It's why I don't think I ever went out there. I was so intimidated by that. On Staten Island, it was kind of unique. I'm writing screenplays.
Oh, you're a big fish. Oh, you're a big fish out there. Yeah.
I'm okay on Staten Island. You go to LA. No, huge. We're all doing that out here.
I can't walk the streets in Staten Island. I mean.
Exactly.
So you get your movie, Little New York or Staten Island, whichever name. I don't know which is the has two names on it.
Little New York. I wanted Staten Island, New York.
Right, exactly. So how did you get that project off the ground?
So I made a deal, oddly, with the French guys, Pascal Cachetot, Sebastian Lemercier, saying if I do write this thing for Jean-François Richer, you guys have to find the money for me to direct something. They were like, okay, we'll make that deal. That was kind of a handshake deal. And then I wrote Assault for Jean-François Richer. We had some success with that. They were happy. Then I wrote this strange little, you know, I'm a Fellini fanatic. So this was kind of my ode to the absurdity of Fellini films that always inspired me. And I've always found my hometown to be quite an absurd kind of place in a good way. Mm-hmm. So then I wrote Staten Island, New York, which they responded to. And Ethan and I hit it off on Assault. Ethan tied himself, you know, attached himself to the project. With the Ethan attached, we got Luc Besson to read the script, and Luc financed it. It was why he had, you know, Europa Corps films, I think they were called.
Yeah, Europa Corps.
Yeah, Europa Corps. And Luc financed it. He was a big fan of the film. So we did, you know, it was good. Listen, I love the film. It never found its total way in America. It played overseas. We did a lot of festivals, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's a weird movie. It's absurd. I've learned that I have a love of absurdity that I need to keep in check because I don't know if modern audiences love absurdity the way I do. So Sebastian's constantly checking, my producer's constantly checking my love of absurdity. So
right. Yeah, the Fellini film's not so box office friendly.
No.
Eight and a half, Not pulling in $100 million opening weekend.
Fine enough, dude, for those films. So I sneak in. I try to sneak in, and as you saw in This Is the Night with the Man on the Roof, Greece with lights on, I sneak in my little bits of absurdity whenever I could.
That makes more sense now. Absolutely. Anyway. Now, so you're working with Luc, man. What's it like working with Luc Besson? Because I am such a huge, monstrous fan of Luc from Big Blue to The Professional.
Big Blue was one of my favorites.
Subway.
Uh-huh, exactly.
I mean, after I saw The Professional, I went deep into his archive. Big Blue is
wonderful.
Oh my God, it's wonderful.
It's really a beautiful movie.
It's a beautiful movie. Yeah. Subway and of course Fifth,
right, too, with you. Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
Fifth Element and then his later stuff as well. But The Professional is one of those films for me.
I agree. It's one of my
favorites. Leon, as it should be called.
Leon.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably one of the most brilliant films I've ever seen.
I think so too. Genre wise, it's one of the best. She's amazing in it. Leon, you know, Philippe is great, and
Gary Oldman
I would say Philippe Noiré. What's his name? Jean Reno,
Natalie Portman, Gary Oldman at his height of his powers. Yeah, exactly. Everyone was so good. What's it like working with him as a producer, man?
Dude, he was great. He gave me one note. He came to set. He gave me a great note on set, though. So he came to set on Staten Island. So you have Luc Besson on Staten Island, which is great. In and of itself, came to set. I was shooting the D'Onofrio scenes in the forest, and he was watching the dailies. Like, I really like your dailies. He goes, but on every fourth or fifth take, whatever you're maxing out at, seventh take, your last couple of takes, he goes, just give everyone the direction of double timing it from camera to actor. He goes, you're going to want the option of everything being a tad faster. So he goes, just give yourself the option. So he goes, just have the camera move faster. If you're doing the pushing, have the actors move a little faster. Because you might at points need to speed things up because it's kind of a slow film on purpose. But he's like, I thought it was a great piece of advice that I use to this day. And then on the movie, he gave me one note too, which to this day, I still want to talk to him about. There was a very graphic sex scene between Ethan and Julianne that no one ever got to see that started the film where they're yelling at it. Instead of saying, I love you, they scream in each other's faces. They want to come up with it. And they're both completely nude and they're just yelling at each other because they want to express their love in a unique way. And their way to do it is to yell. And it's an odd scene, but it's very emotionally wrought with all this like passion. And he's like, I remember he called me, and don't forget this. I was in Manhattan at the time. He's like, James, I love your film. He goes, but I have one note. He goes, you have to cut the first scene. And it was my favorite scene. I'm like, why? He goes, your movie's jazz and that's heavy metal. And it stayed with me. I'm like, you said it too elegantly, man. I can't come back after that. And he was not wrong, but I fought to keep it in for – it held the movie up for a year and a half. And he's like, okay, you could fight all you want. Show me cuts because I know I'm right. And it was – we cut the scene.
So you fought off a year? A year you were like trying to –
He let me fight, dude. He let me keep recutting to try to fit it in because I thought maybe he was responding to that it came first. And the movie has a disjointed time structure.
We
were able to move it around a little. He never bought it. He never bought it.
He's like, nope.
And he might be right. Listen, I'm not sure, but – you know, it was one of those things that I'll live with. I still think about to this day.
When you get notes from like Coppola and Besson and or Carpenter, it's hard to. I mean, you're talking about you're talking to Monet and Van Gogh,
exactly.
And,
but the masters, the guys we grew up. I mean, who taught us how to do this?
Right. Yes. So when they give you a note, it's hard to not listen. And they might be wrong. They're human, but
they could be wrong. Yeah.
But it's hard.
Really, it sinks into your soul and makes you truly contemplate it. Like, You can't dismiss it. Whether they're wrong or right, it can't be dismissed. So, yeah, it's tough, man. It's tough.
So, all right. So that first shoot, that first directing gig you got, what's the toughest day in that whole shoot? The day that you felt, because I love asking directors this because I know what it feels like when you're on set and you're just like, the whole world's going to come down around me. I'm this close to a panic attack because of this pressure or that pressure or this actor's not doing this or the line's up or we're losing the sun or the rain's coming or the camera blows up. Or what was that day for you and how did you handle it?
Dude, it's a great question, man. And it's happened on every movie. There's that day, right?
There's always.
You'll never get every movie and every movie. Hopefully I get to make more movies. So every movie will have that day, multiple days where you're like, it's not working at all. It's not working. Like what we're doing is not working in any way, shape, or form. There was a scene with D'Onofrio. You know, D'Onofrio's character goes and lives in a tree. He was a mob. You can tell the whole movie's about Staten Island is battling their feelings of insignificance, being where the forgotten borough. So insignificance is permeating. It's a triptych. So you have this crazy mobster who, to become somewhat infamous in his life, he's trying to break the underwater breathing record, and he can't do it. So he tries other things to do. It's a very strange story. And he's trying, I'm going to save the forest that they're knocking down. So he goes to live in a tree because he knows they can't knock it down if he's in the tree. But I had too much dialogue. And this was a great lesson as a whole for me as a filmmaker. He's up in the tree giving this soliloquy that went on. And it was a dialogue with a cop who's trying to get him down. The dialogue wasn't working. It was simple as that, dude. I wrote bad dialogue. Vincent knew it. I knew it. The crew knew it. Everybody knew it. I'm trying to rewrite on set. We're losing light. It's starting to rain. We're already over budget. You know, all this shit's all at once. But I can't let it go. I'm like, I got to fix it right now, here and now. So I'm literally with pen and paper. They got me on like a cherry picker, running pages up to Vincent, who's sitting up in the tree waiting for me, harnessed in because it was very high. I'm afraid of heights. So I'm like having panic attacks going up and down in the cherry picker, trying to rewrite. And I don't think I ever got it right, dude. I don't think I did. I still to this day was like, I didn't get it. We missed it. I missed it. Yeah. Yeah, and it's that day. And you can't foresee that. And we still try it, Sebastian and I, my producing partner. We still try to foresee that day now in the script form. Like, can we see that day? And we talk about that day on set. Can we first? And you can't. You can't predict what day that will become that thing. Because you don't know if it's an actor. Yeah, you don't know what's going to do.
It could be a million. There's so many different variables when you're shooting on set. It could be an actor. Could be the script's not working. Could be the lighting's not working. Could be the camera. The lens fogs up because the heat.
Exactly.
You know, it starts to rain. You're losing sunlight. Oh, the location you had, all of a sudden, they're like, no, we're not shooting here today.
Absolutely. Yeah.
There's there's just so many variables as a director you have to hold on to. But there's that one special day, because there's always that. Every day there's a little bit of that.
Right. That's always there. Right. But there's that one day where you don't get it right. That's why it stands out, I think.
Yeah. And I think it's when multiple of those things hit you at the same time.
Exactly.
It's like that's the day the producer shows up like you're 3 days back. You're three pages behind. You're three pages behind.
You're 3 days behind. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, after 3 days, you're three pages behind. This is a fiasco. If you don't get this taken care of, we're going to shut down the production.
This is a small time Heaven's Gate. Get your shit together. Cut it out.
You see that guy over there? That's the bonding company guy.
Exactly, the bonding company.
He's going to take over this film in 2 days if you don't catch up.
Oh, yeah. Because you know all the stories, right? Coppola, there was a director down the set. He says, waiting in a car. I forgot the guy's name.
Oh, yeah. Right? For Godfather. Yeah,
exactly.
Godfather.
Exactly. Even Stone says on, I think, I just read his book, man, if you haven't read it.
Oh, no. Yeah, I had Stone on the show. I had Oliver. Oh, what a great book. Great book.
Oh, my God. But that really explains, like, the pressure that he was under where I was just I mean, you think these guys weren't. Meaning, when we look back upon these masterpieces, we think they were made probably easily. No, they weren't at all. They came from, like, tension and anger and passion and no money. And so,
When he was on the show, he was talking about Platoon. And, you know, he just came from El Salvador. He did Salvador, you're in the middle of a war zone. And he's got like government army people shooting. Like I think he directed two horror movies prior to that.
Right. In fact, The Hand and something else.
Yeah. The Hand and something really early in his career before he even won the Oscar for Midnight Express. And when he's shooting Platoon, and Platoon was just because he only got Platoon made because the producer, I forgot, he's like a legendary genre guy. He's like, yes, I like your movie. Let's move. He's got the cigar. And he has that the accent. It's like,
exactly.
We make your movie. You get $6 million. And he's like, let's go to the Philippines. And that was it. And he was literally in a war, and he's got. Remember the cast of Platoon? Johnny Depp was like in it for 5 seconds.
Panning. That was Johnny Depp sitting there as the translator. It's the weirdest thing.
I forgot who it was. I think it was Charlie Sheen or somebody. Was like, we're like huffing through the freaking jungle, dying. Yeah. And you see Oliver Stone like a general on a Jeep just passing us while we're walking to set. He's just like rolling by.
The peasants.
But
we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
You know, it's fascinating. I mean, and I think this generation of filmmakers don't really get this. Younger filmmakers don't get the battles that the 70s and 80s guys went through. Exactly. Even the 90s too, but really like to try to make Platoon today.
Oh.
Try to make Full Metal Jacket.
No, you're not getting it.
Apocalypse Now. Freaking Taxi Driver. Imagine like the wars that these filmmakers went through, even Spielberg with Jaws, that they went through, stuff that the younger generation doesn't really understand, I think, a lot. That's why Hearts of Darkness.
Yeah, it shows what he went through. Exactly. And I would say that's the biggest personal indie film, most expensive indie budget or tour film ever made, right? I mean,
until his new one that he's about to make.
Right. Oh, I can't. And he had Megalopolis, written back when I was working with him 25 years ago. I mean, even before that. And it always broke my heart over the years. I remember talking to Lawrence Fishburne about this on Assault.
Mm-hmm.
We were brokenhearted that a man of Francis's stature couldn't get the money for Megalopolis. I'm like, why can't someone step up and give him the 150 mil and let that man of all men, who you're not going to give it, how could you not give him?
Well, if Netflix or Apple doesn't show up or Amazon doesn't show up, someone's got to come on, guys.
Yeah.
You gave Marty 200 million for Irishman.
Exactly.
I mean, exactly. You could give him 150 for Megalopolis. I mean, but I'm so happy. I just had this conversation with another guest the other day. I was like, I'm so happy that a man who's 82 years old is by all stretch retired, yes, more money than he ever needs in his lifetime, finally, because he's been broke a million times because of his insanity. I'm going to go back down. I'm going to throw down $100 million.
Throw down his own money, dude. Think about it.
To do this story because I think the world needs it.
Exactly.
We need guys and gals out there taking those swings.
Yes, we do. And we need guys who can take the swing, meaning – well, I mean, he's trying.
There's only a few that can.
There's only a few who could take those swings, right? So we need them to do that bold work because maybe that'll create a new era of the bold work like we had in the 70s, you know?
Well, I mean, look, and we could talk about Cameron Cameron, every time he goes up to bat, he changes the game.
Absolutely.
From The Abyss to Aliens to Terminator to True Lies to Titanic and Avatar, he changes the game. Literally changed the industry with Avatar, and Nolan is taking these huge swings up at bat. You know,
well, Nolan's doing it now. He's taking the reins, right? He's taking those big swings, I love seeing Quentin take the huge swings lately too. I mean, I was a huge Once Upon a Time huge fan. I can speak about that movie all day. So we have those guys, and they got to keep doing it because not everyone has that freedom. It's only a few.
And the thing is, where are the young guys doing that? You know, like where
the system is making it too hard to do it. I don't know. You know, that's what I wonder. I don't know, dude. It's hard to say.
I don't think, I don't think, God, it's like the guys and the gals who are getting these opportunities, there's very few who are going to get the same kind of shots that they did because the game has changed so much.
Completely.
The game is completely different. Like we were talking earlier, it's like it doesn't have Spider-Man in it, good luck trying to make a $150 million movie. It just doesn't make financial sense for the studio to take a risk like that.
Not anymore. Exactly. Yeah.
It's
gone, right? The audience is just gone. So they know.
It's
tough. That's what's terrifying. Again, that's what goes back to my movie. Like, is it going to be all cinema is going to become like opera houses where we're only seeing certain kinds of films, the Marvel films, and always everything else will be relegated to streamers. That's what's terrifying to me as we move forward.
Yeah. It's
how do we financialize it? I don't know.
I don't know either. I don't know where it's going to go. But I've always said that, too. I think that cinema is going to go the way of Broadway, where it's going to be, it's going to be $50, $150 tickets to go see an event film that costs $500 million.
Exactly.
And that's, and then there'll be the art house films and those things that maybe go to the Alamo Draft House or those kind of films. But it, it's not the 80s, 90s, early 2000s. It's gone. I think those days.
That's scary. Yeah.
That's scary, but we'll see, man. Like, I think
we'll see. We can always hope.
We could always hope and pray. And I know, I know a lot of the younger listeners are like, these two old farts talking
these
about.
These two old farts talking about
the old days about
Rocky III. What is he doing?
Yeah. Exactly. What is Rocky? But anyway, Rocky. So I got to ask you, man, when you write, do you, what's your writing process like? Do you outline? Do you start with character? Do you start with plot? How do you start the process?
Whether it's, I think usually it's some kind of conceit, dude. Some kind of like, oh, some world that I'd like. The Purge was a conceit first. Mm-hmm. You know, of this crazy day, this new holiday in America.
So it started off with the theme, the plot, essentially.
Yeah, the theme, yeah. It was like this, you know, yeah, the conceit, the theme, the story. I think usually story-based, not character-based. Man, that's not true. I shouldn't say this. Everything's different, but whatever I do start with, I just start jotting down little notes. I am an outline guy, though. I do build to an outline. So I believe in the outline process for myself. And the outline, I don't want to say is more important than the script, but it is the architecture upon which the script is built. So I take a lot of time on the outline. Constantly going over that. I write on little cards. I put them on a wall, and first in a book, then the cards, and I type them up so they're really embedded in my brain. And then once that process is done, then I'll go to script. And the script takes a shorter amount of time, I will say. If I do well in my outline process, the script process is a tad shorter. But then my rewrite process is immense because I do give the script. I have my readers who I love and trust, who I do believe every writer needs, because I think we have to listen to people and look for patterns. I think they don't always know, but you can, when talking to people, you can see the patterns of what if they're all focusing on the same area or the same character, you know, there's a problem there. So yeah, it's a hell of a process in that. Yeah, the outline is actually the biggest part of my process, I'd say.
I'd agree.
Are you an outliner?
I'm a huge outliner. I outline my books. I outline my scripts. I outline everything I write. Because it just makes life easier. It's just like you have all these. Yeah. You have everything laid out. Like, okay, now I just have to write this scene. I don't have to think about where this scene goes, at least at this that process. Exactly. And when I'm laying it all out, it just the writing process just like almost, it's just like you're just adding in stuff. But like the building of the foundation, you know what it is? It's like building the house. You need the frame and the foundation of the house. And then you can decorate. Right. Decorate, oh, I'm going to put the room here now. I'm going to put the wall. This color is going to be purple. I'm going to put this. Yeah. It's so much easier. And I know a lot of writers love to like it. They hate the concept of outline or structure. And I'm like, guys, you can't build a house without a foundation and walls and beams. But within that structure, you could do 1,000,000,000 different variations. How many houses are there in the world? You know, architecture.
Yeah, exactly.
But you need that as opposed to just like, I got a bunch of wood. I got a bunch of cement. Let's just go. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, I need to know where I'm going and what I'm building to. And someone said to me, well, don't you want to be inspired? I'm like, fuck yeah, I'm inspired in the outline process. I'm running around my room. I drink some tequila. I got my head. You know, music is a big thing for me too. I pick one track of a song. Either it's a soundtrack, one track of a soundtrack, a song, something that represents the movie to me in one track. And I put it on a loop and I keep it on my office 24/7 during that period. So whenever I enter into the office, that song is on and it puts me right back into the movie. So that's a big part of it.
That's really cool.
And it's finding that song is the hard part. That takes some time too. It's like, okay, what represents this movie wholly in one track that I could keep on that loop? Anything from Bjork to Hans Zimmer, you know, I'll find something that represents that particular piece. You know, Floyd, I wrote like, you know, Purgy. You know, I think the third Purge was To Welcome to the Machine by Floyd. It could be anything, you know, anything that kind of, whatever the fuck I'm feeling at the time. So, and that becomes incredibly helpful to find the perfect track, but it takes time.
When I was writing a script once, my music was the soundtrack of Desperado and from Robert Rodriguez's Desperado and Sergio Leone's all of those, just the whole and it mixed that whole. I do a mixtape. An old school mixtape, but on but on my playlist. And I do that and just let that run again and again and again and again while I'm writing.
While going, right, exactly.
Because it just gives you the...
Yeah, it gives you that juice, that energy.
Well, I mean, I think it was Robert said in an interview once that he was writing... I forgot one of his scripts. He was writing to the soundtrack of Dracula and John Carpenter.
Yeah.
And he was just like, he just had the soundtracks playing in the background as he's writing. So I love your idea that like you leave the room, you have it on 24/7. So the
24/7. So when I entered, I'm forth like Pavlov's dogs. You know, I'm like, I'm back. Exactly. Exactly.
I'm back in.
I know Greg is right. I don't want to.
So man, The Purge. What the hell, man? I think that should be a quote, like The Purge. Yeah, what the hell, man?
What the hell? Why?
No, I mean when I first saw it.
Let me just write. Sorry.
So when I first saw the trailer to The Purge, I'm like, first of all, that is genius. Whoever came up, why didn't I think of this? Which I'm sure a lot of people thought because the concept is so high. It's just like, there's one day, all crime is legal. Go at it. That's all you need. As far as a log line is concerned, you're just like, shit. And you could make these movies from here, and which we've made a few. You're doing it again. So how did you come up with The Purge, man? How did you get into that?
Dude, it was weird. I came up with, I guess the seed of it started when I was in, I was posting that Luc Besson film, the first one, still the first one I directed. I was in France. They made me post in, which was wonderful. So I was living in Paris, meeting Parisians and Europeans. And it was, again, this kid from Staten Island, like, this is a strange life. I've walked out to Forrest Gump. Mm-hmm. But I noticed the relation. I've never been a fan of guns. I've always been very scared of guns. I grew up with a lot of cops. They had guns. I was just born naturally inclined to retreat from the gun. I never took to it, as some people do. But I noticed the relationship with guns in Europe was different than I had seen in America. There was just something different. I don't want to get too political here, but it was just different to me. I'm like, this is different. No one has a gun here. I knew a lot of people with guns in New York and in other places I've traveled, Florida and whatnot, here in America. So that was in my head about, and I was always, shootings were beginning to happen. Mass shootings in America were on the rise as they were happening in the 2000s, still happening. So all these thoughts were in my head. And I was living in Canada or on something else for a couple of projects. And it was different there too. The feelings, they had guns, but it was still different. Long story short, I was in a road rage. It all coalesced together. I was in a road rage incident with my wife in Brooklyn on the BQE, on the Gowanus, sorry. A guy cut us off. He was drunk as hell. He almost killed us. I got into a fight, literally fist fight with this drunken lunatic. I get back in the car with my mom, my wife, Freudian slip, with my wife. And she says something that stayed with me forever. And she's a nice woman. She's a doctor. So she didn't really mean it, but she was all passionately aggravated by this crazy person. She said, I wish we all got one free one a year. And I knew what she meant. Like, well, we all had one murder we can commit without going to jail. And it just stayed with me, dude. It was just one of those statements that stayed in my head. Oh, that's a dark statement, babe. But I took it home. And in thinking about the lack of gun controls in America, that was always bothersome to me. It all just came. I woke up one day with this idea for a holiday that I thought could be a metaphorical kind of discourse on what I felt was the lack of gun controls in America. Like, how far can we take this? Where can this go in a very science fiction dystopian kind of world, or utopian as The Purge pretends to. And that's where it started. And then I started outlining, doing my thing, listening to whatever track I was listening to. I was listening to Penderecki, I think, at the time. That was the track that when I was listening. And I finished the script. Sebastian was producing, my producer, my producing partner, who I keep referencing. But we started sending it around. Even Luc Besson said it's incredibly anti-American and so nihilistic and dark that he didn't think he could finance it. And Luc wanted to make my next movie after Staten Island. He's like, it's too dark. It's too anti-American. He didn't see an audience for it. Many people, that was not just Luc, 50 people said that to us. Like, literally, we just kept getting the same anti-American sentiment about the whole thing. Blum, I knew Blum from 20 years, but not 20. Well, at that point it was 10 years, but I knew Jason in 98, 99. He had optioned a couple of scripts for me right after he left Miramax, and we hit it off. He was good. We just became friendly, stayed in touch. He was starting to do the horror thing. I sent it to him and he's like, oh, this fits my low budget horror model. We can do this in one house. It fits perfectly into the world I'm doing. I have a new deal at Universal. I'd like to be my first film at Uni. I'm like, dude, I wrote this to be like a Michael Haneke, like Funny Games, a tiny film we play at the Angelica in New York. I don't see the mass appeal for the film because, like people have been saying, it's incredibly dark and anti-American. And, Greg, bump the next one, dude. We're all good. Great.
All right.
So long story short, Jason got it. They read it at Universal. They thought it was quite dark too, but they were like, okay, it's your low budget model. Maybe we'll take a shot at it. even after watching the first cut, they didn't know if it was theatrical, but like it is quite dark. And but listen, Jason kept pushing. I give Jason the credit. He saw the mass appeal, I guess, of the conceit. And
it is, but it was the first Blumhouse.
It was the first Blumhouse at Uni. He had done, I think, what's the Insidious, but not at Universal. Yeah. Somewhere else. Insidious started, I think, Paramount. So we were the first new under his 10-year. At that point, it was a 5-year deal. So and dude, even that opening weekend was a shock. They told me literally the day before that tracking said we were doing 10 mil. And I was like, oh, that's good for a $2.5 million film. Even my agent said, if you do 10, that's a nice weekend, man. All I'm concerned with is I want to make another film.
Of course.
So what do I need? You know how that is. You know, it's like, how do I get to do my next film? And I kept saying to my agents, like, what does it need to do so that it's not considered a disaster and I'm in director hell? And they said, well, if it does 10, that's a wonderful opening. And then we ended up doing almost 30. So I think everybody was shocked. But it was a crazy weekend, dude. It was almost like the Jack sale. It was one of those very surreal, weird nights.
Yeah, and I think it was I think when you watch a film like The Purge, it's a release. The same release that you feel if there was a night that you could do anything is the feeling. Okay. So it was kind of like a way to release a lot of pent up. I think it still is. All those movies is a way for people to kind of release in a safe.
In a safe way, right? In like a roller coaster way. You get to scream and yell and let out.
Right.
There's a catharsis to it, right? A societal catharsis, like we say in the movie. And yeah, it captured something.
Big time.
Yeah, it captured something, dude. It's still hard to define what that totally is because different people have different interpretations of the film. You know, black audiences have almost a different interpretation. We saw that I don't want to say it's a strong racial divide, but even when I made part four, when I hired Gerard McMurray, he said he was in college. They would teach The Purge as a metaphor for black plight in America, about how the impoverished and the blacks were treated in American society. They took the whole movie as a metaphor for that. And I was like, wow, this is incredible how the movie is being interpreted across the country. So yeah, strange. And even the European audiences, you know, it's called American Nightmare in Europe. So they look at it as a very, you know, strict, strong indictment of the American system of violence, you know, how we deal with guns and violence here. So it's interpreted very differently around the globe.
So as a writer, as a creator, as a director, there's very few times in a filmmaker's career, if ever, that you get to tap into the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
This film taps into the zeitgeist. It is it's an adjective now. People use it as like, oh God, I just need a purge. You know, I wish I could do a purge today. Yeah. Like it's something that's really within the zeitgeist. I gotta ask you, man, what does that feel like to like just be a creator of something like that? Like some of the greats that we've talking about, like obviously Francis with The Godfather, it's in the zeitgeist. Obviously, The Purge and The Godfather are not the same film.
No.
But it has entered the zeitgeist. What does that feel like as a creator?
Dude, it's still strange, man. It's still weird, and I don't take any of it for granted. It's even though sometimes I have purge fatigue, I'll be the first to say it, but I don't take that for granted that people truly seem to have loved it and adopted it. Like even my cop buddies say it, all the Caribbean Day Parade, I think was recently, they start the parade every year with the purge sirens. Even I was watching, I'm a big baseball fan. I was watching, I think, a Tampa Ray. I think it's the Devil Rays. They use, every time someone strikes out, they play the purge sirens as the strikeout theme. So, and that happens. I see that all the time. You know, I'm like, oh, those purge sirens are like, they've really, truly entered in. And even on Halloween, the weirdest thing is seeing kids in the neighborhood in both Manhattan, where we're in Manhattan and Staten Island. Both neighborhoods, you'll see totally dressed up as characters from the film. That's the one that gets me the most. I also run over kids when they're too young. I'm going, you haven't seen this movie, have you? You shouldn't be watching this yet. but like me, they are watching films they shouldn't be watching. So, man, it's weird and it's humbling and it's still, I don't take any of it for granted. We're so lucky that we got to make, I thought it would be one film, so that the fact that it's five, maybe six, I wrote six. So who that, you know, it's strange, man. It's strange.
You wrote, so you've, was it like you just kept writing a bunch of them or are you like, are you doing them one at a time?
One at a time. I'm usually fueled by the political climate of,
election day. Yeah.
Exactly. And then four and five got even more political because I think I can be very political and the directors we hired to do four and five, I didn't direct four and five, were even more political than me. So we pushed it even further and the studio has to keep us in check so we don't start proselytizing and preaching, which we want to do, but we easily could, I guess, within the format. But yeah, so no, I write. So the new one I wrote, I didn't think I was going to write another one, dude. That's the all honesty. I was like, I'm done with the Purge. Five's good. It's the end of America. And Purge 5 ends when it feels like the end of America. I woke up 8 months ago and I had a new idea. And no joke, I called Sebastian. I pitched it to him and he was like, I hate you because I like it. And he's like, we're going to have to do that. So we pitched the bomb. He liked it. Peter Kramer at the studio liked it. So I wrote it.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So I have the script. Everybody's happy with it, but I don't know enough about the financials of the business to see if they want to. I don't know yet if they know what, because of COVID. Well, and what
performed, yeah, right now, maybe not. But the thing is, too, that each one of them has done gangbusters. Like, they just keep making money. And
they do money, dude. Yeah.
Keep making. Like, and some go, like it keeps growing, like, you know, worldwide.
The third, I mean, which is very rare. Usually they go down.
Yeah. Here, yeah, like always.
This. Yeah. So, you know this. Yeah. So this one went up in 4 or 5 because of COVID. We went down a little bit. But I think
still,
from my very amateur business perspective, it seems like it did okay during COVID. It's very hard to tell anymore, dude, during this. Yeah.
I imagine on VOD and all that, they do.
Yeah.
It must do insane business.
Yeah, maybe VOD could have helped. But they don't share those numbers with me, though, sadly.
Yes. why would they share the numbers with the creators? That would be insane. That would be insane. Okay. Now, I got to ask you, man, what's it like working inside the Blumhouse family, man? Because, I mean, he's got such a unique position in Hollywood. There's nobody else that has he's got. No, it's insane.
He found some little niche, man. I give him. He's like the new Roger Corman, you know, in some way.
But with a studio backing.
Yes, with a studio behind him. Exactly, dude. And he's got green light power up to a certain point. So he's got great power, and he protects the. He really protects me, creatively. And he's not Jason when he hires you. When you get hired into the Blumhouse world. He kind of is, the hiring is, that's the most input he has in the process. Meaning, he's like, I've hired you to make the movie. Now you go make the movie. I'm not going to interfere with that. Yeah, he has, you know, Cooper Samuelson, who's one of his, like, right-hand man over there. You know, you get some creative input from Cooper. But for the most part, you're left alone to go make your film. And that's my favorite part of working at Blumhouse, is there's great creative control. Now, with the Purge series, there was a studio, the head of the studio, Peter Kramer, who became a great ally of the series, and we worked with him creatively. So we had Peter too, but Jason is a great defender if the filmmaker wants. You know, there was a lot of, the end of 3 was in question at that point. Jason really backed me on what I wanted to do at the end. And it got a little tense with the studio, but they're wonderful to work with too. I can't bad mouth Universal at all, because I actually think what they're doing is kind of ballsy with, you know, there is a strong political commentary within The Purge that many studios, I do believe, would shy away from. And they kind of let me and my partner filmmakers explore these potentially, you know, when they're trying to appeal for the most part at studios to the four quadrants, you know this. When we start saying something about guns, even though it's metaphorical in the future, that could put off a part of the audience. We know that. They let us do it. They really don't make us, because I think The Purge is so inherently sociopolitical, it's impossible to not make some commentary on the state of affairs within American society. And they let us do it, man. I give them credit for letting us do it. Now, we do work on the strict budgets. I will say that. We're not making, we don't have Jurassic Park and, you know, Fast and the Furious budgets at all. We have that catering budget, maybe. And,
You got Vin Diesel's writer budget.
Exactly. Yeah, so I got his lunch money. So it's So I think that helps us retain the freedom, because if we started going higher up in budget, obviously higher budget, less freedom. And Jason makes us very well aware that it's hard. It's very hard to make the personal decisions. You know this too, dude. Shooting action, like shooting horror on a low budget is one thing. Shooting action on a low budget is very, very difficult, because you got squibs, you got stunt work. And we have, as I said, Purge films are not just horror films to me. They're more action horror or sci-fi. Mm-hmm. So they're very hard to make, and it's very hard on the crew. I'll say that we've had some nervous breakdowns on set by many crew members, because we're just pushing them too hard, including myself. I mean, we're all in it together, but we are under very strict parameters budgetarily, which I think allows us to have that freedom.
Right. And if you can make it for a price, you have all the freedom you want. But if you had 30 or 40 million bucks to make a Purge, they're just going to be more people involved, because there's just more at risk.
It's as simple as that, dude. Exactly. Exactly. And I'm dealing with that with my new one I just wrote. It's not a Purge film, but it's this movie I'm doing with Pete Davidson, that we know if the budget's higher, you know, Jason said this too, if it's higher, it might be with Jason, it might not be. But if it's higher, we're going to have to start dealing with notes, a lot of notes. You know, if we keep it low, we're not going to get many notes. And it's a tough thing because I also want some toys on set. I want the time to build, you know, a creative vision, a directorial vision. And sometimes when you're running and gunning, you don't have time for that extra special shot. And that's where it gets to. And then, and as I've now done so many films on that run and gun style, there is a point where you step back and say, I'd like to play a little more. I'd like to have a little more freedom.
So a techno crane every day.
Exactly. One day. Oh, Steadicam or techno crane.
No. Every day. When I was in Florida, True Lies was shooting. And I went down to the set in Miami just to see James shoot. And I was in high school or something like that. And I went there and I had a couple of friends of mine who had people in the business who were on set. I didn't get to go on set, but I was right outside of set. And they go, did you see that back there? It was every single toy filmmaker could ever ask for. Cranes, Steadicams, technos, helicopter, sitting. Sitting.
Back there. Yeah.
Sitting. Just in case James wants to play with it.
Oh, dude, that is so foreign to me. Because I literally gun to my head. They're like, tell us what day you need that techno crane, and you got to use it that day, and you never get it again. And on This Is the Night, I really wanted a techno crane in the theater sequence. You know, when they're in that theater, because I thought that needed to be very operatic, poetic. So that was it. I got my techno crane that day. God forbid, like, that didn't line up. I don't have a techno crane again. That's it. So,
and
yeah, that freedom, you know, you start, I love the freedom that I'm not getting notes, but then you start looking at, well, then I'm, you know, directorially, stylistically, you're locking yourselves in to just, you know, going handheld or maybe on sticks and maybe a dolly.
Yeah.
But when I see the toys that, you know, Nolan and Cameron, all these guys have, you're like, oh,
IMAX.
Yeah, exactly.
Techno crane IMAX.
Yeah.
No. And for anyone directing, if you've had the pleasure of shooting with a techno, you'll understand why you can never go back. It's so different. I shot something with a techno and I had it all day. And I was just like, what have I been doing my entire career? I need a techno everywhere.
Because people don't realize with a techno, you could do more than what you think you could do with a techno. Meaning even standard shots, you could throw on the techno, right?
You could just shoot. And you could just move that. You just move it anywhere. And it's
Do
it across the table, go around here. Even if you just want to do setup changes, you just
You could go on, that's
boom,
what I'm saying. You
do done.
The simplest, like, oh, let's just reverse done. Here, guys, the techno.
Faster. And you just move here so you don't have to move the entire crew and the dolly and the tracks and the
exactly.
Oh, you know, God, don't get me started. So yeah, that's
freedom. You start saying, well, maybe do I sacrifice, get a bigger budget, but then I have to deal with notes. So it's, you know,
it's a balance. It's a balancing act.
Yeah, exactly.
And by the way, almost every filmmaker has to deal with that. I mean,
exactly.
Even at the highest level.
Yes.
You know, unless you're Spielberg, Scorsese, Nolan, Fincher, you know, you get what you want at that level. But at a certain point, you know, you're going to have to compromise. Everyone's got to compromise at one point or another.
I think movies are compromise. And then the question is, how do you compromise creatively and not go from 10 to 5? How do you maintain a 10 with the compromise? That's, I think, the key. If you could figure that out, then you're God. But you know, it's like that Five Obstructions movie. Have you seen that Von Trier film, The Five Obstructions?
No, I've never seen that one.
I'm going to babble quickly. You got to see it. It's about... So Von Trier takes his film school director and he gives him an experiment. He says, you're going to make because Von Trier says the best film he ever saw was this guy's. His name is Jorgen Lett. Jorgen Lett's student film, Von Trier says, is the best film ever. He goes, you're going to make it 5 times. Each time, I'm going to give you a different parameter to work within.
Wow.
One will be no sound. One is the actors can't move. And the last parameter is no parameters. You could do whatever you want. And Lett says it's the hardest of all. He says, every time you gave me something, I was able to figure out how to work within it. When you gave me nothing, I didn't know what to do. And it's a fascinating, says something about the process to me that sometimes the parameters are good because it forces us to get very creative, but sometimes they can be very bad. So
yeah, imagine if someone gave you $200 million for a Purge movie, like your head would explode.
I wouldn't know what to do. I'd be like, I got to shoot in the water. I wouldn't know what to do. Where do I go?
Do I need a dinosaur? Okay, I'll put a dinosaur in. Like, I mean,
dinosaur purging. Yeah.
I mean, is the Terminator come back? Do we have the rights for that? Let's just throw the Terminator in.
Exactly. No, it's crazy. Crazy.
Now, I want to talk about your newest film, man. This Is the Night, which I absolutely adored. I watched it yesterday. It's fresh in my mind. Our friend Greg, when he pitched the story to me, I was just like, the whole movie is surrounding the release of Rocky III in Staten Island.
Yes.
And I'm going, what? First of all, awesome. Because I remember watching Rocky III in the theater, and I saw that belt come by, and the Rocky III came up, and
absolutely, yeah.
I remember all of that, and I was just like, "Oh my god!" And obviously, Rocky III and IV is, you know, they're amazing. All the Rocky films, almost all the Rocky films are amazing.
Almost all.
Five we don't talk about, but
we don't talk about five, right?
We don't talk about five, but one through four, and then Balboa, and even the Creed.
Creed's great.
But so. Tell me, man, first of all, how did you pitch this idea to the Blumhouse and just go, hey, man, we're going to do this movie about the opening, surrounded around the opening of Rocky III. And we were talking about earlier, it was like, it's very specific.
It's like
the opening of, like, you know, Goonies, or the opening of Howard the Duck. Like, it's such a thing. But I mean, Staten Island and Rocky, I get it. So please explain. Please explain it.
Dude, I think Rocky was such an immense figure growing up here in Staten Island and Brooklyn. To me, it was always the Italian-American thing. But in speaking to people, it seemed to transcend the Italian-American experience. But it was big here, very big. I mean, to the point where people would dress up as Rambo and Rocky in school. I remember the day before the Rocky movies, people would hold Stallone's posters. Everybody had a Stallone shirt. Everybody owned Rocky. Like, that was also, like, I tried to get into the bully in the film, like, this Rocky's not for you, he's for us. Like, there was an ownership of who loved Rocky more, who, mm-hmm. you know, but it was an immense love of the character that really just tore into the culture of the Italian American culture, especially where I lived in the South Shore of Staten Island, mm-hmm. white Italian American. So I always had this, it was such a big thing, even in my family. We had scrapbooks on Rocky, it meant something to us. I don't know if he was this blue collar guy who rose up, you know, that we just loved this idea of the American dream, that an Italian American could win, that we really adopted this character. So by Rocky III, that mythology had grown. And I remember waiting 3.5 hours online for Rocky III, and the whole island was there. I mean, it was fights on the line. People were fighting for seats, fighting for position on the line. The local mob boss had showed up. There was a lot of mobsters in my neighborhood. So all that stuff that's in the movie was very real. And the excitement of the movie, the building, I cut a scene out where Anthony wakes up and he's yelling into the neighborhood, like, who's got the paper? What time's it starting? It was just too long, the opening. But so that was all real. That's all very autobiographical, that excitement for the film. I always wanted to capture that, because also it's not just about Rocky. Yes, the specificity is there. And that's, I think, a lot of fun. And it was a big thing here. And I think it was a big thing in the country. It made $100 million, the film. But mm-hmm. for me, the movie is about my love of cinema and how it inspired me and how I was touched by all the still to this day, very touched by these movies. They would stay with me, inspire me, change me, give me empathy for various cultures. Whatever they did to me, they taught me. I always said my religion was cinema, and I wanted to pay homage to that. And also specifically, I wanted to pay homage and really encapsulate what I think is a magical experience of being in a movie theater, which I don't think can be replicated at home, no matter how hard we all try. I have a huge screen. I tried to make it at home. It just doesn't. That communal setting of us all together. And I hope it doesn't go away, as I fear. So the movie was an homage to that experience, and I hope people still have it. I know they have it with the Marvel films. I feel like it's going away in some other aspects of our industry, but it was so prevalent, so big to me, such a part of my childhood. And I know other people, so I know this is, I think, a more universal feeling. Yes, it has the specificity of Rocky III, which is really fun, I think, but hopefully, and in is one specific scene in the movie where I show them, watch the family and the community watching Rocky III, but I purposely don't show the film. I really don't. I only show it down the barrel of the lens. And it was a big editorial decision. Everybody was kind of fighting me, like, you need to show Rocky III. And I'm like, no, it's not about Rocky III. It's about the people watching it. It's about the emotional response. Even when I met Sly, he's like, James, you got to show the movie more. And he was wonderful, Stallone. But he's like, you should show the movie, you know, show Rocky III more. So we tried it. It didn't work because suddenly you want to watch Rocky III.
Right?
You actually want to stop paying attention to Rocky III, the narrative. And it changed the emotional response to what should be is about these people reacting to what they're watching.
And so, if I may say, the way you shot the experience of watching Rocky III was beautiful. The shots of the projector and the light bulb turning on, and then you would see the upside down. You see the film of the Rocky III coming in, and you see the upside down projection of Rocky, and you would see, and I found myself looking like, what scene is that? Like, okay, I know what scene it is. Like, it's like almost there, but it's not there.
Yeah.
It was because you had me, because that brings me in, because you're like, what's going on? Because I know, I mean, Rocky III is one of those movies that if it's on, just turn the remote. Rocky IV is on, you're like, if anything, you fast forward to the training montage and the fight.
Exactly.
it's just one of those, those are the kind of movies those are. Yeah, let's just go to the fight sequence. I could watch the fight sequence a million times. I could watch the training sequence. No. And then I want to go, and I got to work out afterwards. I'm like, I should be working out more.
Raw eggs and work out, right? That's what Rocky does to us. Yeah. So it's
but, very funny. And a lot of the stuff that's in the movie, the subplots, the topics you tackle are wonderful. And how you tackle them with kid gloves, you really did. I mean, you talk about bullying and finding your own identity and the toxic masculinity of that era of your fathers, of our fathers. And, it was just that generational thing where you really touch upon a lot of things. And it's such a unique thing because it starts off as one thing and then it turns into another feeling. And then there's that absurdity. When I saw the priest, or what was it? The priest on the
priest on a skateboard with a
skateboard with Christmas lights. I'm like, what is going on? But now that I've spoken to you, I'm like, this makes sense. Yes, this makes perfect sense. You snuck in your Fellini scene. I appreciate that, sir.
Thank you.
But it's wonderful. When's the film come out?
So it comes out this Friday, playing in Manhattan. So we got a very small release, but we got a release, which makes me very happy because I think, how do you make a movie about the communal experience about theaters and not have it at least in a theater in New York? So it's playing at the Village East in Manhattan, the Angelica. And yeah, we'll be there for a couple of weeks. And then we're on PVOD, video on demand. And people could buy the film next week on the 21st or the 22nd.
Okay.
And then eventually Netflix, eventually. I think that's December, though. That's far away. So.
Oh, nice.
So people will get to, they'll get to see the film, which is great. And I hope it drives them to the movie theater. That's the goal. Like, see the film at home. If you have to see it at home, but go to a movie and see another movie. That's okay.
It's okay. It's just, it's fine. Just do it. Exactly. Now I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all my guests. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
The longest to learn is to get out of my own way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Oh no, the road's not. There's nothing in the road. Hold on, let me throw some crap on there.
Exactly.
To make it a little tougher on myself. Oh yeah.
Let me make it a little tougher on myself. Get out of my own way. Get out of my own head. Get out of my own way. Yeah.
Three screenplays that every screenwriter should read.
Oh, Rocky. Rocky one. Got it. Rocky one.
Yeah.
I read the first draft of Benjamin Button, not the one that got made. Oh, who's the writer? Female writer. Oh, this is terrible. I wish I could remember her name. It was so beautifully written. I wish we could look. We both should look this up at some point, dude. I'll find out and send you the. So the first draft of Benjamin Button, written in the 90s, that it's not the one they used for the movie that we saw, was the most beautiful script I had written at the time. And then I would say any Steve Zalian script, any screenplay by Steve Zalian is beautifully written. Oh, and one more, if I could add one more, Unforgiven by David Webb Peebles.
Oh, Unforgiven. Yeah. Jesus, that's such a great movie.
Yeah.
And three of your favorite films of all time.
Oh, okay. God, it's going to be so cliched. Godfather 2, Raging Bull, Apocalypse Now. I know it's boring, but that's the top three.
I would say Godfather 1 and 2 are just one movie for me. It always is.
Yeah. We fight about that one day.
You could sneak that in if you want to get the two in.
Yeah. And then my Fellinis come right there. Roma and Amacord and Cuckoo's Nest and Cool Hand Luke and Dog Day are right after. I'm going to sneak those into the pocket.
Jesus, that's awesome, man. James, man, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you, brother.
Same here, Alex. Fantastic.
The show is always open and you're welcome on anytime. I know we could talk for a good 4 or 5 hours more just geeking out.
Let's keep in touch, my friend. This is wonderful.
Appreciate it, my friend.
Thank you, man.
I want to thank James so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thanks so much, James. I recommend everybody go watch his new film, This Is the Night. I absolutely loved it. And I think you guys will too. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/159. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast.
at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.